The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
ELC. Yeah, there it is. When that robot voice comes in, you know it's time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to
ELC.
Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks in sneaks, using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or, hey, maybe you're just relaxing today. Maybe you're taking her easy. Maybe you're hanging out with your favorite pet and just strolling through the woods listening to the DLC podcast. Well, we're going to be with you in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be. And that is completely free thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. They bring the show to you. Their generosity, their support, their desire to see this show continue means we get to make more of them. And in return, they get some cool stuff, some perks, including ad-free versions of the show. They get video versions of the show on demand, and they get bonus content, ladies and gentlemen. So much bonus content. You got an entire season of Feeling This, the show where Alex Solman and Christian Spicer tell you about the feelings behind video games. Season 2 coming soon. They get bonus chats, spoiler chats, exclusive and early. And the paid DLC program, our Wednesday check-in show, where Lana Bashinsky joins Christian Spicer and myself to talk about whatever happens to be going on. We get surprise guests jumping into that show as well. Oh, it's a good time and it's so much fun. And it can be yours if you support the show at patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, it's the show all about games in their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata. That's spelled with two N's and one T. And I am joined, as always, by my friend slash co-host
slash nemesis.
The guy who's feeling baseball fever, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Jeff. Hello, everyone. With this intro this week, taking your favorite pet on a walk into the woods, dear horror film auteurs, please feel free to use a poor victim, a cold open victim, listening to DLC in your movie. You can have that, right?
Cross-promo.
Yeah, just have someone put in, you know, have your little first victim put in some, come on, pet, let's go for a walk. Doon, 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 doon. But you got to, you know, and then they're bopping just the podcast. They're just like, yeah. Oh, yeah, this is so great. And then they're dead. So that's what I want. Make that happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's like the horror version of John Wick. Like you murdered my dog and now I'm dead too. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, we got a great show for you coming up. We're recording a teensy bit early, but oh my goodness, we have an awesome guest because we're able to do that. And I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, you know the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, I am excited because DLC stands for Digital Lives of Crime. Because we have the host of Virtual Criminology, the video game True Crime podcast, as well as video producer and award-winning streamer for Eurogamer, Mr. Ian Higdon is with us for the first time. Hi, Ian. How are you?
Hello, I'm great. Thank you so much for starting early, all because of me. Different time zones. I've got you up early. I do feel a bit guilty about it, but yes,
not at
thank
all.
You so much for inviting me on.
It is our delight to have you. And I'm actually, crazily enough, I'm actually flying tonight to the UK, to Britain. So it's a wild, wacky bit of serendipity that's all coming together.
Yeah.
And we're excited. We're excited to talk to you.
Well, it's been raining the last couple of days, but the weather looks good for you. So, you know, we've got the weather good for you over here now.
I appreciate that. I can't wait.
Demands it. He doesn't travel anywhere without good weather. He came out back to L.A. for spring break, and it was like L.A.'s 1 week of rain.
It was
pouring.
And then
he built into his contracts for all future travel, weather.
Well, in the UK, we have like 1 week of sunshine and the rest is rain. So hopefully you've come at the right time.
we had like 3 or 4 inches of snow yesterday at my house. So, you know.
Wow.
It's okay. It's all up. It's all, it gets better from here. All right. Well, let's jump in and start the show the way we always do. And that's with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week. It's the Story.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happen in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also send us comments or questions or anything you'd like us to know. We're there. We're listening. We'd love hearing from you at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also participate in our communities. We have a subreddit. 5x5dlc.reddit.com is where you find that. We also have a Discord. Fantastic folks hanging out in the Discord. That is also 5x5DLC on Discord. And hey, the DLC Book Club is in full effect on the Discord as well. We have a DLC Book Club thread, and we're reading Gardens of the Moon. Lana Bashinsky and I are putting out videos on YouTube about it. Join in on that as well.
With author contributions and comments.
Dude,
like, you guys are, it's
pretty
incredible.
Awesome.
It's like, don't worry about it. Man, I'll listen to the episode and then I'll go to the comments to get insight from the author.
Yeah, Steven Erickson is hanging out. Listen to the book club and giving us clarification on his books. It's pretty cool. Anyway, Ian, you are our guest.
Yes.
And so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Well, my story of the week is one that was actually brought to my attention from one of the developers of an upcoming VR game called Firewall Ultra, which I went hands-on with recently for Eurogamer. I was one of a few outlets that was able to go hands-on with this upcoming sequel to one of my favorite PlayStation VR 1 games, Firewall Zero Hour. I was invited to Sony's HQ to try out Firewall Ultra, the sequel. And I was guided through a couple of multiplayer games alongside some of the developers from First Contact Entertainment. And during that playthrough, I got to grips with the mechanics of the game and the controls and everything. And one of the things that really struck me about this game, coming from the back of playing one of my favorite PlayStation VR 2 games, Pavlov VR, was that in Firewall Ultra, there's no reload mechanics to the guns. It's button press reload only, which is very simplified. And I can kind of see why First Contact Entertainment are doing this. It's obviously part of Sony's push to get newcomers into VR and stuff. If you've ever played Pavlov, you'll know that the manual reloading is quite complex, and you have to have your VR legs about it as well. So Firewall Ultra kind of features these simplified movement mechanics. And when that news broke, when people's hands-on articles came out, a lot of the hardcore VR crowd were like, what's this? We don't want button reloads. We want to, you know, we want to feel cool. One of the best things that I love about Pavlov and its manual reloads is how you can feel like John Wick playing these games. You can pop a mag out, you can pull one from your hip, slap it back in, start shooting again. It's great. With the button reloads, it's so simplified that, yeah, a lot of the VR hardcore were quite disappointed. But then a developer reached out to me via DM to point out a story in uploadvr.com where they were reporting that during a live stream, one of the developers, it's actually First Contact Entertainment CEO, Hess Barber, jumped into a live stream and told everyone, basically announced that there is going to be actually a new Ultra mode coming to Firewall Ultra in the future post-launch. And this is going to introduce manual reloads, friendly fire, and no aim assist. Now, another one of the things that was introduced during that preview was that Firewall Ultra has a kind of aim assist to it. When you hold down the grip button, it brings the sight of the gun up to your eye and slows your movements down. So for a bit of fine aiming rather than having like a virtual stock like you might do in Pavlov. And this separate mode is going to be more for the hardcore. It's going to be separate to the public matchmaking, and it's going to be for, you know, pro players, and it won't replace the simple button press playlist or anything, but it is going to be there post-launch in an update for those that prefer to play that way. So that was great news for me. I was really happy to hear that, because as much as I loved the original Firewall Zero Hour, I've been playing so much Pavlov that playing Firewall Ultra with its basic controls did feel like a bit of a step backwards in terms of immersion and excitement. So yeah, very happy to hear that there is an Ultra mode coming post-launch to Firewall Ultra.
Very cool. Yeah, I mean, I am a bit conflicted about my physical reloads in VR games, because I love how cool it feels. And I love how different than, you know, 2D flat gaming it is. It is something that's unique to VR that makes it feel special. And there's a tactile nature to that is very, very appealing to me. Mm. But I will say, when the S is hitting the F, when the zombies are rounding the corner, when the militia is coming down on me, when other players are, popping up, it often becomes very comforting to be able to have that button reload.
Oh, yes, definitely. Oh, the amount of times I've been like in a shootout and started to fumble with my magazine, dropping things and stuff. But I'd sacrifice that for having those awesome feeling moments. I remember playing Pavlov a couple of nights ago with some friends, and I got in this shootout where I was ducking behind some cover, and I had a six shooter on me, and to like open that up, you do press a button and it opens up the cartridge, whatever it's called, and you shake it to let the bullets out, and then you have to put each one in manually and then flick it again, and then I was poking my hand over the cover and shooting, and it just, I was like, I was there in that moment. It was incredible. And I think a button reload, you do lose that. So happy to have that balancing act of sometimes fumbling and getting a bit scared with the realism.
I agree. And part of that joy is in that inefficiency. You know, the joy is in how many steps it takes to do it, and you're under that pressure, and oh my goodness, I have to actually physically do it. And I would venture to guess that might be part of some people's frustrations with VR in general, is that things that video games tend to make easy and simple and fast, in VR you're actually doing it. You know, that, you know, we've abstracted things so far, you know, press X to do whatever, press X to mourn, press X to, you know, that in VR, when it's like, oh no, we're tracking you, you actually can do this. You got to actually pull the lever or rotate.
We're eye tracking you. You are not mourning at all.
There's no part of you that's mourning.
Your eyes are happy. I see no tears.
No tears detected.
Yeah. I find that, for the most part, I find that joyous and refreshing to actually have to physically do the thing, climb the ladder or whatever it is. But I think there is a segment of gamers that just want to min-max everything, including their physical movements. And I wonder what your opinion is on sort of that, the sort of what would you call it, barrier to entry being partly physical.
That's one of the major problems of VR, is there's always going to be massive barriers of entry in terms of not just wearing the headset itself, but also learning to operate games in a completely different way. I think that's great that Firewall Ultra is going to have two options now, one for beginners and one for the hardcore, so you can balance both. But yeah, in terms of Pavlov especially, there is a huge learning curve to it, and it did take me a long time to get into it, but once it clicked, then I was in another world. I have never been that immersed and that you know, getting, I love a good game of Call of Duty and everything, but there's something different about VR shooters that really put you in the moment and give you an excitement that I can't get from the flat screen games. So
yeah,
there are a fair few easier shooters to get your head around in VR, but in terms of hardcore loading weapons and stuff, once that clicks, then, you know, it's the ultimate immersion for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm right there with you. And it makes, you know, one or two enemies so much more dangerous and exciting, you know. And in Call of Duty, you can mow down, you know, 15 people without blinking. And, you know, in a VR shooter, you're in it. Things are much more heightened.
There's a brilliant zombie mode in Pavlov where they charge at you. It's like the zombies from 28 Days Later. They sprint at you. And if you start fumbling your reloads and you're like trying to slip a magazine in and you drop it on the floor and then you see these zombies coming towards you, that is a panic you won't feel in a flat game. I can guarantee.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to convince people that dropping your magazine on the floor is fun or exciting, but it is. It's truly pulse pounding.
And then when you get it in there and you pull the lever back and then you're firing it off, you're just like, whoa.
Yeah.
Okay, this is what it feels like to be the star of my own movie. Right. You know, I am John Wick. I am a survivor in a zombie movie. It's no feeling totally like it.
Christian, where do you come down on the physical reloads in VR?
I love options. I think I talked about it for Resident Evil 8, like for whatever reason in that game, and I think it's because I played the pancake version of it first. It felt weird to then learn these physical reloads, but that game gives you an option for a lot of button pressing of that stuff. And that felt better for me in that experience. So I still had the immersion of the world and seeing, you know, huge creatures looming over me to scale and in 3D space, but I was also able to play it in a more comfortable way that I wasn't fumbling through the mechanic of, like, if it doesn't work right, then I feel like you even lose that panic immersion of, like, if I'm not opening my jacket to get my mag out every time when I want to, that's frustrating. And I think it was the disconnect I had in RE8 of how I had played it and now how I need to play it that prevented that clicking for me. So I really love the option of a button press. But as a motorsport fan, and someone who still insists on driving a manual when I go around a racetrack, I totally get it, right? Like, a manual in every car, you know, track purpose built car is slower than automatics. Now, F1 cars are all paddle shifted. Like, what you can do with a computer assisted transmission making these gear shifts for you is going to be night and day different than me roaming my own boat. But the immersion of using all four of my limbs at all times feels great. You know, like, that's the experience I want. I'll take the slower hit to be in control of where my RPMs are and how I'm coming out of an apex or whatever. And I think VR does a lot of that same stuff where, yes, it's slower. Like you mentioned climbing. It's like, yeah, in Horizon, which we'll talk about in a little bit, it's press up to climb, you know, more or less. And in Horizon and PSVR, it's like you're doing everything. And in that game, I think I enjoy doing the climbing more than just like, I'm going to run Aloy against this wall. I'm going to jump around this wall. She's going to bounce against this wall. Does this one climb? Does this one climb? Nope. Okay, now I'm going to do this one. So I love it when it clicks. And then I also love options for when it does not.
I was playing a lot of After the Fall on PSVR2 for a while. And they do kind of a hybrid thing you can do where it's almost like the old light gun games in the arcade, like House of the Dead and stuff like that. You run out of, you know, your magazine empties and then you have to tap your chest and it'll reload. So it's almost just like, you know, the old games where you have to just shoot off screen and then back.
Or like Pistol Whip. You just cock it down.
Yes, right. Bam. Pistol Whip. Great. Great pull. And I even enjoy that, you know, like that's sort of a hybrid between the two where, yeah, it's not as fiddly. It's not as precise. It's not as tactile. But it's something that is different than just pushing a button, which I enjoy as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, very exciting news. I know that we'll hear more about that in the what you've been playing segment. Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
Oh, there's a lot of stories. I think a bigger story, Jeff, and maybe I save this for a Wednesday. I think there's too much of conferences, and none of them mean anything anymore.
We've gone past the Rubicon at this point.
E3 died.
It's great. We don't have to. Every company can have its own direct, and it's like, oh no, every company doesn't need to have its own direct.
Or every company's having 8 directs, and they're all interesting. But at the same time, it's like none of them are. It's like, how do you break through the noise? It used to be, how do you break through the noise of like just press releases? And it's like, oh, we would do these E3s, these big conferences, and that's how you break through. And now everybody's doing their conferences. And it's like, how do you break through? We're doing a PlayStation Direct. No. This one's a good one. This is instead of like the set your expectations low, we're only going to talk about these two games. Just know what we're going to talk. It's like, no. Get hyped. And then it's like, is this the one where you announce Silk Song's date? No. Okay, call me later. So maybe that's a longer discussion, and maybe you can bring up some of those specifics. But for me, the story of the week, I think, this week is Sega's acquisition of Angry Bird developer Rovio for almost a bill. And I think...
that's a pretty big roundup.
Sorry. Well, the original negotiation numbers were a bill, and now it's like $7.75, which... You know, if you're going to give me $7.75, I'd be okay saying that's almost $10. But yeah, I guess when it gets to the millions and billions, it's
yeah,
a little different.
Well, I mean, a few hundred million among friends, I guess,
or among buying video game developers. You know, yeah. It's all pennies. This feels big to me because we are seeing more and more movement toward mobile game companies being purchased by quote unquote traditional AAA publisher developer companies. A big part of Microsoft's long coming acquisition of Blizzard or Activision, as it's often discussed, is actually the acquisition of King. They're very profitable, almost always out of the news, mobile company that doesn't have an egocentric or doesn't appear to have an egocentric jerk of a CEO or whatever Blizzard also has. I guess it's still Bobby for both, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this idea of companies pushing into mobile. Tencent obviously has a large mobile presence, and the mobilefication of other games, Fortnite being very successful and then having to walk that back because of App Store. Genshin Impact, huge on mobile. And then also these more traditional, quote unquote, mobile games like Angry Birds and the like, still doing really, really well. And I think this is interesting because I think you haven't heard much from these developers other than other versions of Angry Birds. Like, yes, there's games, but nothing that's like been in the zeitgeist. But Sega clearly thinks they have an acumen or an insight into that space in a big way, and are looking to get into it because, as we learned at BlizzCon 2019, everyone has phones. And, It's the place I think a lot of people want to be to get all that money. And I'm curious if you all think this will lead to something or if this is just another blip on the road of Sega's post-console life.
Yeah, evidently Rovio also has this live service tool called Beacon, which I think probably is a big part of why Sega values them so highly. But yeah, I mean, clearly this is not about acquiring Angry Birds, right? The goal for Sega wasn't like, oh, we got to get that sweet Angry Birds money. I think it more is we have a bunch of IP that we think will work on mobile. Mobile is a big, big burgeoning market. So let's get a company that knows how to make mobile things and has this built-in infrastructure that has this tool, this live service tool. And we can just flood, you know, our IP into a completely new revenue stream. Ian, what is your take on this acquisition?
I think you're spot on there. I reckon, you know, Sony are going to use Rovio to push their IP out onto mobile phone, whether that means it's a Sonic the Hedgehog mobile game or, you know, maybe, you know, I don't know, Sonic the Hedgehog in a Pokemon Go style, maybe something like that. Bringing the Sega titles out and about into the palm of your hand, out into the open world. You know, there's the sky's the limit, really. There's been plenty of home console versions of Angry Birds. So, yeah, the chances of Sega spinning off a big new console version of Angry Birds seems less likely to me than, you know, what you said, their IP's going mobile. So
yeah.
I think that's what I'm expecting to see from them.
Well, evidently, Sega believes that global gaming market by 2026 is going to be 56% mobile. So mobile gaming will account for 56% of the global gaming market by 2026, according to Sega. They want in on that. You know, that's over half the pie. So they want in on that. Anecdotally, I will say, this last weekend, we had 9 6-to-7-year-olds in my house. not by my choice. My wife invited them.
You left the doggy door open, and it's like you were looking for the clip, but it was on the ground, and they were rushing in. You're like, no, they come in.
If you leave a Nintendo Switch by the doggy door, bad idea. No, we had a little get together with the for my son and daughter here, and the kids came over and had pizza and fun stuff, and then they were going to watch a movie, and I said, okay, here are your options for movies. We could watch Star Wars. We could watch Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. We could watch, what was another one of them? Like I can't remember. I think it was a Pixar movie. Or we could watch Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic the Hedgehog! The bonkers, everybody. Sonic! Sonic is huge among the 6-to-7-year-old set, at least in my neck of the woods. And I think that's pretty wild, seeing as how it's not like, you know, it's not like people are playing. I don't think the kids are playing, what was the last Sonic game, the open world Sonic game? Frontiers. Ooh, yes. I don't think they're playing Frontiers.
No. You know?
I don't think that's what's causing it. It's the cartoon. It's the movie. It's the fact that the IP is interesting to kids. Mm. And I think Sega's like, well, let's give them something on the mobile. You know, let's look it up.
Yeah. And they've had mobile games before, certainly. There's good ones on Apple Arcade, even. Sonic Racing, I think, is a very good racing game and on a mobile service that I think is good in terms of, you know, delivering that type of content. And there's been other, I think Sonic 4, right, was originally released on mobile. And there's been other Sega games on mobile. But I think at the end of the day, you kind of look at the cost required to own a studio that can do all this stuff and navigate the App Store policies and uploading, updating, getting your game out there and having all of that in-house versus the cost and time associated with finding an outside developer who's going to be able to do this, or the company that can help you navigate the App Store policies, or, you know, and like these bespoke arrangements for each game. And now hopefully, you know, Sega has the equivalent of inside counsel, right? The call can come from inside the house every time, and they don't need to start looking for a partner. And I think for this amount of money, and again, as Ian mentioned also, with all the IP that Sega has, I think it makes a lot of sense. Streets of Rage 4 was awesome on mobile. Just a regular game, and you could play it touchscreen or with control. I think there's a lot of value there for them.
$775 million. I'm guessing those birds aren't quite as angry as they used to be.
Yeah,
heard the pigs got it all.
Oh. It's not cheap.
Oh, nice! Well done.
Thanks,
Ian, with the win. I love it.
That's the show, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
If there's one thing I'm good at, it's terrible puns.
Well, you fit right in. Terrible puns and VR. Oh, yeah. We're kindred spirits. All right. So my story of the week, Christian, as you mentioned, you've left me a bunch of really interesting options. I think I'll probably there was a big Street Fighter VI showcase, but they dropped a demo, which I have played. So maybe I'll get a chance to talk about that in the what we've been playing segment, because there's a lot there and it looked very interesting about what they've done to Street Fighter VI. I think I'm going to focus on the other showcase of the week, and that is the Nintendo Indie World Showcase. I love that Nintendo does these. I'm a big fan of indie games, as listeners to this show will note. I'm always trying to talk about as many indie games as I possibly can. And Nintendo's been doing such a great job making the focus of the Switch, in large part, indie games. And evidence of that is these kinds of indie directs, these showcases of specifically games made by indie developers. The showcase focuses on the developers themselves. A lot of times, a lot of this showcase that they just did on the 19th had a lot of actual developers presenting their games or introducing their games. And there's a lot of really cool stuff. a lot of cute games, a lot of adorable games. A sequel to Crypt of the Necrodancer called Rift of the Necrodancer that would look pretty cool to me. It looked very different than Crypt of the Necrodancer, but still a rhythm action game with a story. There was a the sequel to Oxenfree, Oxenfree 2 Lost Signals, Oxenfree game that Christian and I both really liked.
Got a date.
Yes. Some really interesting games, I think, here. I will pick out, I think, a game that I wasn't aware of that I'm very curious about is a game called Animal Well, being developed by a single human. And that person was introduced the game in a very humorous, fun way and was like, I've been working on this game for 5 years, did everything. It's almost out. Here it is. It's very, very, very charming and funny. It looks really interesting. It's a game. He described it as a game about exploring places you're already familiar with, but finding something new in them. And I thought that what a cool thing to focus on. What a cool prompt for a video game experience.
Yeah, I've never heard of this game before, man. Just looking at some screenshots now, it looks great.
Yeah, yeah, pixel art, really sort of retro look to it, but it looks really interesting. I hadn't heard of it either until this point. But you know, it's one of those things. This Indie World Showcase we've said it so many times. There are too many games, and there are specifically in the indie space. I don't know how anybody makes money. Because there was this showcase where games would get about two and a half, 3 minutes, in this 20-25 minute presentation. And at the end, they're like,
here's like eight more games. We'll just show you for a few seconds.
just don't blink. We got a few more.
It's like, well, I mean, cool that Nintendo is showing your game for a few seconds, but there's just so much.
And this is just Nintendo's indie world. Steam also had its Next Fest, and yes, the PlayStation is going to showcase some hot indies coming to PlayStation, and Xbox has ID at Xbox. And also, are you asleep? Because wake up! There's more games! There's a game under your bed! Look in your closet! 100 games!
It's wild. It's wild. I'm very excited about the Cult of the Lamb DLC that they showed, and another game called Crime O'Clock perked my interest because it doesn't look like anything I've ever seen before. It's kind of this, the idea is you're solving crimes through time, crime o'clock, there's different time frames, but it almost looks like a Where's Waldo, big zoomed out, highly detailed line drawing of a city in these specific time frames. And then you can highlight different parts of the city that change based on the crime that's happening, the heist or the whatever the crime is that you're trying to solve, and you affect things in one time frame, and it'll carry forward through time and have ramifications. It looks so different and interesting. It really caught my attention. But I wonder, Ian, if there's anything in this list that you are particularly interested in.
Well, you know, I actually missed the Nintendo Indie World Showcase, so I'm just kind of catching up on this now. But I did hear about the Cult of the Lamb DLC. My wife was a huge Cult of the Lamb fan. She smashed through it so fast. She got,
like, how big of a fan? Like, should we be concerned, fan? Like, are you okay? Do you need help? Are you safe?
But there are more than a couple of plushies in this house right now, and various t-shirts. So, but yeah, I'm pretty safe. Maybe not so safe once the DLC comes out, which I think is next week.
The plushies aren't being used to suffocate you. Like, you're alive. You're not being asked to do weird things so that she can prosper. Like, everything's okay.
I'm always asked to be doing weird things. Not with the plushies.
It's more lamb than cults, really.
Definitely. No, I think that DLC's out like next week, I think.
Yeah.
It's a bank holiday weekend over here in the UK. So my wife was like, I know what I'm doing, bank holiday weekend. So I'm not going to be speaking to her because she's just going to be cult managing all the way through, I think. I did enjoy the original Oxenfree. So I've not seen too much about Oxenfree 2, but that had, that was a great story. And
It looks to be very, very similar. You're back on this island 2D, exploring the story, picking up strange radio waves. And there's like a walkie-talkie system now. You can talk between characters. Looks pretty cool.
I like the list here that says all the games announced. There are a lot of cat games.
There are a lot of cat games. Mm-hmm. Indeed, there are.
As a fan of cats, I'm happy about that.
There you go. Little Kitty Big City, Quilts and Cats of Calico, which is based on the board game Calico. It's literally the board game Calico. And then they added cats on it. So nice. I was like, okay.
Yeah, and even in the screenshots of Animal Well, there's some cats in there as well.
So, there you go. Know,
if you like
and
cats.
I think Minico's Night Market is all about cats as well. Mm-hmm. Cats making a big play for Nintendo's Indie World Showcase this
cats
week.
The
Stray
internet.
Was nominated for a game award? Okay, give me some more cat ideas. Yeah.
Cats are hot! They're hot! cue the guy sitting behind the desk with a big cigar. I need cats!
Exactly.
Christian, any standouts for you?
There are a few. Also, as we were talking, you know, looking at how many games there are, I think Nintendo does a very good job typically with pacing of these directs, like putting together a weird mix of games. I mean, just look at this list and it's like Blasphemous 2, Little Kitty Big City, Cult of the Lamb DLC, also Plate Up. It's like just whiplash. Bomb Rush, Cyberpunk, which is kind of a spiritual successor to Jet Set Radio or Jet Grind Radio. I think that looks awesome. I'm curious to see how it plays and controls. I think Jet Set, you know, even with the updates over the years, it was kind of built for the Dreamcast controller, and then adding full dual analog control, the game, I think, lost a little bit of its appeal, but it also is very dated in how it originally played. But I love that world. I love that vibe, and I'm excited to see new folks do something with it. And I also think Oxenfree 2 is probably my biggest, like, Metal Gear Solid exclamation point interest game, because we talked about the first game. I listened to the soundtrack for the first game still regularly. The second game, I feel like, much like Silk Song, which I joked about earlier, this game was announced a long time ago. And I feel like now it's finally coming. And I'm curious how much more new they're bringing to the table, or you know, not that games are easy to make and it should have come out sooner, but I'm like, oh, is there something else going on here? Like, is there a like the first game was secrets and uncovering mysteries. And I wonder if there is like some, I don't know, but like some change or some drop or something else that happens, or, you know, maybe games are just hard to make.
Yeah. It's certainly lots of cool stuff in the Indie Direct. And I really appreciate that Nintendo has committed to this and continued with this, you know, shining the spotlight on indie developers and making the Switch this destination for indie games. It's really cool. All right. Well, that brings us to the games that we have been playing in a segment we call The Playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on The Playlist. Ian, what has been on your playlist this week?
I've been playing a couple of games this week, mainly Meteor Maker, which is this month's PlayStation Plus game, and also Dead Island 2, which came out on Friday, I think.
Yeah, well, let's start with Meteor Maker. You've been playing, this is a post-apocalyptic first-person building and raiding game, right?
Meet Your Maker is a really bizarre game, and the best way I can describe it is Mario Maker meets Doom, which
what a cool description.
It's a very weird game, and it's not going to be a hit for everyone, but for me, I got super hyper, like, focused, addicted to it in such a short amount of time that I've platinumed it already. It's not been around for a while, but basically, I mean, it's not been out for a while, a long while, but basically what you do is you live in this post-apocalyptic world, and you have to go out on these missions to player-made bases, which are full to the brim with one-hit kill traps, and you have to make your way through in first person using a grapple hook, kind of Doom Infinite style, and a weapon that only has like three projectile darts to fire, and you can get them back by going up and collecting them again. But you have to make it through these mazes. Sometimes it's mazes, sometimes it's temples, sometimes it's like underground things. And that's the beauty of user-generated content. You never really know what you're going to get, how hard it's going to be. Sometimes you'll find like an outpost that's super easy to get through and you'll come out with like loads of loot. Sometimes you'll find one that takes ages to beat. And those are the ones that really got their teeth into me. The ones that were almost impossible to beat. I was like, I'm so stubborn. I was like, right, I have to beat this now. And I just keep dying over and over again until I finally got it. But basically, you go out on these raids. You have to raid a material called gen mat, like genetic material. Any other resources in that gen mat, once you get it, and you get back out of the base, you get to keep that and you can use that to spend, to upgrade, buy new weapons, buy new armor upgrades, and also buy traps, because the other half of the game is building these bases yourself. And you build these bases, you fill them with traps, and then you set them public, and then other people try to raid them, and then you come back later on and you can then see exactly where people have died. You can hoover up a little bit of resources that they've dropped. So it's a game of two halves. You get resources from raiding other people's bases. You get other people's resources from them raiding your bases. And then you bring them back and you use them to upgrade your traps, upgrade guards, and give them special powers that you can then put in your outposts. And I don't know, I got super hyper-focused on it. And it was the only thing I could think about playing for like an entire week.
That sounds really cool. I'm wondering which half of the game you found to be most. It sounds like everything is feeding into you building your own levels.
Mm.
Is that accurate, or were you getting more joy out of doing other people's levels?
I definitely got more joy out of doing other people's levels. I really liked going into it. You in your base, you have this like map, and you can pick which one. And there's a little screenshot of each base, and so you can see which one. And there's brutal bases that give you more resources than the normal bases, so you know, you pick which one you fancy and you dip in. And I just loved exploring other people's bases, seeing what kind of crazy traps or tricks or different ways to torture the players I could find. I did build a couple of bases just because that was part of the trophy system, you know.
Yeah. 100% gotta get that platinum.
Yeah, exactly. But I found the base building to be a little bit more, well, it was, you know, a lot slower, and I didn't find it as interesting. There are some people that obviously just spend their entire time building and making these incredibly complex, almost unbeatable bases. But they're kind of the fun ones to go into, the ones where you're terrified to turn a corner because you don't know if you're going to step on a panel that'll shoot darts into your face, or disappear a wall and then a giant guard covered in armor will come out and get you. But yeah, if you're a fan of that kind of Mario Maker style, you know, you never know what you're going to get, plus with the first person aspects of Doom, then I'd suggest giving it a go. It's a PlayStation Plus game, so it's not going to, you know, cost you anything if you're a PlayStation Plus member. It's not going to be a hit for everyone, but you never know. You might be like me. You might try it for a couple of times, think this is weird, and then the next thing you know, just 20 hours have gone by and you're like, whoa, I'm on your 30th base of the day. So yeah, I thought it was
really interesting. I'm one of those guys that likes these kinds of games, but has no patience for the building aspect. You know, mm-hmm. I love Mario Maker because I can play infinite Mario levels, but I'm not going to make my own. And so that's why my questions are directed this way.
Yeah.
You talk about, getting through the levels and getting resources. Are all the resources you're gathering to build other levels, or is there some kind of reward for just playing other people's levels?
No, the resources you get, I think there's four different types of resources. The gen mat is used to basically build your player level and your base level up, but then you get three other resources which are used to either buy new weapons, upgrade your weapons, buy new player outfits. There's two suits you can wear. One is for long range, so you can shoot traps from a distance, but you have limited ammo. And then there's a close range melee one, which has a bit more ammo, but their ammo won't destroy traps. It'll only kill guards. So you can level up your character depending on your play style, with some resources and then other resources, you can spend exclusively on buying plots of land to build your base on, or, you know, upgrading and modifying your traps. You don't have to build. Mm-hmm. There is a forced tutorial for building, which takes about 10 minutes. But after that, it's up to you. It's a good way to farm resources because people play your maps when you're not even online. So you come back in later on, and the announcer in the base will be like, your base has claimed more lives. And then you can go in and you can check it out. Cool. And you see, yeah, you see exactly where your traps have killed people. And there's a little replay station.
It's the same thing my wife said when those 7-year-olds were in our house. Your house has claimed more lives.
That's definitely a more dangerous trap as well, I think. But yeah, there's even a little replay station in your base that you can go to, and you can watch other people's replays of them trying your base.
Oh, that's
so if
fun.
You're really sadistic and you've made this terrible, terrible death trap, and you're like, ah, how have I killed people today? You can go and watch these replays, and you can then use that to see how people have got through your base. So you can be like, okay, that corner there is not as dangerous as it could be. They're cheating through there, so I'll put a spike trap there and stop them and all that. So yeah, it's a game of two halves, but I focused on the raiding rather than the building, and that's fine, I think.
Again, that game is called Meet Your Maker. Sounds like, yes, a really clever concept that I've never really seen done before. Quite like,
I think,
this.
So it feels like an experimental thing. It's made by the developers of Dead by Daylight. I can't remember their name, but it's made by those developers. And Dead by Daylight's got quite a big community behind it. It's quite a
behavior
big
interactive, I guess.
That's the one. Yes, yes. And this one feels almost like they had an in-office game jam one day, and then they span it out into its own big game. But yeah, it's great. I love it. And I think they're bringing like seasons to it at some point where you can, you know, get more outfits and stuff. But I honestly, I've 100%ed it now. So I don't know whether I'll go back to it, you know, for a while.
And on Steam, it's only $30. And as you said, it's on PlayStation Plus. So Meet Your Maker. Very cool. Mm. But you've also been playing Dead Island 2, which is a game I have been excited about. It's just, there's this explosion of games that just came out all at the same time, this concentration of games. And I haven't had a chance to even try it, but I'm so curious. This is a game that's been in development.
You were first to see it, Jeff, right? Weren't you first to see it?
No, that's Dying Light 2. Yeah.
One of the other delayed zombie games that finally came out. I got it wrong. Dang it.
7 years before it came out. So Dead Island 2 has been in development, you know, that long also.
Well, yeah, to be fair, I actually did see and play Dead Island 2 in 2014 for a Eurogamer preview at Gamescom. So this is when it was being developed by Jaeger Interactive. They were the first people.
Yeah.
Then it went to Sumo Digital, and then to Dan Busters.
Yeah.
I think at one point we were developing it also. Like, it just kind of, you know, went to, you know, anyway. It's like,
I think everyone's had a go now, yeah.
Yeah, we all got a chance.
I did a couple of blood effects in it, and then I passed it on to the next person down the street. Yeah.
I tried to put cats in it, but I, you know.
Yeah, there are no cats in there, sorry. They cut that, sorry, Jeff. Yeah, well,
classic me. But tell me what your experience with Dead Island 2 is. I'm so curious about this. It's set in Los Angeles. You know, very curious.
A famous island of Los Angeles.
Yes, the Dead Island of Los Angeles. We all know it well.
So I was very pleasantly surprised. You know, 9 years in the making, and it is one of those AA style games that you maybe got in the Xbox 360 kind of days that are just fun to play. You know, they're not gonna stand up at the video game BAFTAs and receive an award, right, but people are gonna have a good laugh playing it. It's really, really surprisingly good looking as well. I think it looks great. One of the things that impressed me the most about Dead Island 2 when I was playing it for preview stuff is the detail to the world. It's an open world game, but it's a modular open world game. So instead of having a gigantic map, it's made up of 10 or so smaller maps that are open world. And you can really tell that the art team had the best time decorating this world and making it feel like a real, living, breathing world that it's so busy and that has just been evacuated. So you've got, you'll go into these buildings that are just full of personal effects, knocked over and smashed and blood up the walls, like so much environmental storytelling everywhere. And it made exploring that world a real joy, because I was just wandering around, nosing at people's DVD collections, poking around the homes of the rich and famous in Bel Air. I did a preview for it on Eurogamer a couple of months before it came out. And they said, you know, this will take you 4 hours to play through. And it took me about 6 hours to play through it, because I was just nosing around, checking out all the, there's an influencer house in there called the Goat Pen. And everything in this game is kind of like based on a Hollywood caricatures. So this is a caricature of an influencer house, and they have loads of podcasting sets and video recording sets everywhere. And then you go down the stairs and they've got pinball machines and a bowling alley and just like so much stuff to explore. And I loved that. And then combining this kind of great attention to detail and this great kind of visual presentation with just arcadey, grotesque zombie battering action. It's just, yeah, it was just a nice, easy game to get into that I really enjoyed playing. In terms of combat, you are mainly using melee weapons to fight these zombies. You do get guns after a while, but it's mainly melee combat. And I will say that the zombies are quite damage spongy. So after a while, if you play it for extended periods of time, you can get hammering the zombies can get a little bit tedious, just because they do take a long time to get knocked down. But recently, I played it on a stream on Eurogamer with my colleagues Aoife and Zoe in three-player co-op, which is what that game allows. That's the maximum three-player co-op. And it doesn't really scale, so it makes the battles a lot faster and much more fun. I would say if you can, play Dead Island 2 in three-player co-op, because it's so much fun. You have a variety of moves you can use, like drop kicking zombies. So you'll be like swinging away with an electrified knife, trying to chop a zombie's head off. And then all of a sudden, one of your pals will come flying past with a fly kick, booting them in the head, sending the zombie spiraling off. It's just the equivalent of a turn your brain off popcorn movie kind of.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's a lot of fun. It won't be for everyone. There's a very, very high level of gore. They use something called gore tech in this game, which the flesh of the zombies realistically react to your weapon. So if you chop a zombie in the face, its flesh will peel away on the face. Maybe its eyeball will pop out and start swinging around. You have elemental weapons which can have acidic damage on, and you can hit the zombies with acid weapons, and then their skin will start melting, and or you'll set them on fire, and then they'll set other zombies on fire. So there's a lot of experimenting with the combat and stuff as well, but yeah, it's a lot of fun if you can handle heavy gore and repetitive button mashing at times. Then you'll have a lot of fun with it, I think.
I really enjoyed the first Dead Island. I agree. It's not, you know, it's not winning any awards, but it's a goofy fun time, and I was excited for more goofy fun with Dead Island 2. So
that is exactly what you'll get, but slightly better looking and slightly less janky.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
There's so many things coming out right in this little window. I hope that one doesn't fall through the cracks for me, because I really want to, you know, play it, especially in co-op. It's so much fun. Cool. Dead Island 2, Meet Your Maker. Christian Spicer, what is on your playlist?
So I was provided a code for Horizon Forbidden West Burning Shores, which I have since run through. And I really want to do a spoiler chat for this DLC at some point, Jeff. I think there's a lot of narrative stuff to dive into and discuss. But also just kind of the world and idea of this style of DLC, which I think is probably best discussed in a spoiler chat. So I can be a little more free with my words. As you can tell, even right now, I'm parsing them here and there. I'm trying to process in real time. This will be spoiler free. I'm going to do my best to I'm not going to do my best. I am. This is going to be spoiler free. And
you never really do your best. So that, well, nobody you. Thought you yeah. were. Oh. You
know. No, yeah, Aloy dies, which is shocking. And then like, and Ellie's watching, which just felt weird. I was like, oh, okay, synergy, get it. And then Atreus is like, no. And I'm like, this is what? But I loved it. Anyway, no spoilers. Horizon Forbidden West, Burning Shores. I'm going to start with what I really love about it. And then I will talk about kind of things that I like less about it. I love that this is post-game DLC. I think that is super gutsy to do.
Yeah,
like they sure. have the data of how many people finished Horizon Forbidden West. And Horizon Forbidden West is no small game. Jeff, you got sucked into the do it all. And I think listeners over the year it came out got to hear your progress. Like, hey, I'm still not done.
Yeah.
Yes, we're going to talk more about this game later, but I am doing everything and I'm loving it. And I'm, you know, working my way through it. And this DLC says, great, don't play me yet. Like, you can't, you'll buy it. It tells you.
Yeah.
You cannot play it.
Which is different than the first Horizons DLC, which was just an area of the map that was kind of high level-ish, but you could go there if you wanted to.
Yes, it worked post-game. Like, they narratively kind of had it work if you were post-game, but also if you bought it partway through, you could unlock the Frozen North or whatever it was called. Frozen Wilds? I forget. Frozen something. Coldies. And I love that. I love that this is post-game. I love that narratively it is post-game. Like, there's no other way to experience it. Other, you know, DLCs for Sony stuff that I've loved have kind of done. Island of Ishii on Ghost of Tsushima had this, like, you got to be at this point in the story to go do it. And it also kind of worked narratively post-game because it's this other thing you haven't found yet, but it does kind of feel weird oftentimes in those moments to do this other thing in the middle of like this other big thing. It's my yeah. problem of go save your kid, but also go start a convenience store. Yeah, I think like, Left Behind. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was gonna say like Destiny 2, you know, I hadn't played Destiny 2 in many years and I got Light Beam. What is it? Light Year?
Yeah.
Light.
Lightfall.
Lightfall. It's like, I started a character because I haven't played Destiny in a billion years. And I was like, everything's happening. And then I get there. It's like, go over to Neptune. Just head on over to Neptune. No problem. Well, yeah. Don't worry about any of this stuff right now. Go to Neptune.
The world is ending. But also, that ended technically. Like, yes, it's bad. But like, go to Neptune. yeah. I like the way, surprise, Naughty Dog has handled this before. Left Behind. You know, you can access in the middle of Last of Us, but also it works as its own standalone thing. And then my favorite is Uncharted Lost Legacy, because they're like, hey, we're going to build this DLC expansion. You know what? It's its own game. Here you go. It's an own yeah. game. If you pre-ordered the expansion for $10, you still get it. But it became its own game. Horizon Forbidden West Burning Shores is definitely DLC to Horizon. And it is beautiful. I mean, just stunning, drop dead gorgeous. The facial animation and the realism in that performance capture that they are bringing, that Guerrilla is bringing to this game, in an open world game, no less. Like, this is not a small corridor, you know, graphically simple, processing simple game. It is still this huge open world, and the amount of fidelity is unbelievable. It is a PlayStation 5 exclusive.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. Is did you see this is probably not possible on PS4 level step up?
I played the first one on PS5 also, right? So not the first one, the main game on PS5 also. So it's not like, oh, this one looks appreciably better than the main game, but there are moments in this game that I do think wouldn't be possible on PlayStation 4. Just in terms of loads and seamless transitions. And I think it's easy to point out some flaws of this DLC, which I think there are some substantial flaws, but I think those can only be viewed, contextualized, in how incredible of a package this thing is in terms of the game loads and then it's the game, right? Like toward the end of Forbidden West, you're able to travel the map a new way. That is just unbelievable, where you can like, oh, I'm way over here and I can see all this other stuff and I can just go there and there's no load. There's no anything like real time. I'm traversing this map in this new way and holy crap, that's incredible. And Burning Shores continues that because this is, you know, post in game content, and it's unbelievable, right? Like absolutely unbelievable. There are new weapons and new robo dinos introduced that I think make some of the best fight encounters once you relearn how to play the game. in the series, the new weapon is really fun and dynamic, and I wish there were more new weapons, and I wish there were more opportunities to highlight the specific use case for these new weapons. It almost felt like, you know, here's this thing, isn't that fun? And now we're moving on. I'm like, no, give me, build a whole game around this thing. It's so cool. And same with some of the traversal stuff that's introduced. It's like, here's this thing, isn't that neat? It is really neat. Could you use it more, please, sir? May I have some more? It's just phenomenal. And I think it's easy to take for granted what Guerrilla has built with Horizon, the franchise, and specifically Forbidden West, and now Burning Shores as well. So I'll stop there, Jeff. I know you've also been playing. Before I dive into my
well, nits, I haven't played nearly as much as you have, and I'm excited to finish it as well, and then we can have our spoiler chat. Yeah, I'm impressed with it too. I think I liked Forbidden West. I liked Forbidden West a lot more than you did. This has been a huge, I've been anticipating this a lot. This is going to game I've been looking forward to a lot, or a DLC I've been looking forward to a lot. I'm doing more of the side stuff than you probably, you know, have patience for, because it's a game that you like, I think, but don't love, right?
Yeah. I lose patience for it's funny. I mean, I just played a bunch of this, but I forget what they call them. I like the meaty optional content, but I'm less excited about the, my cat's missing.
Oh, like, dude, got to find those cats. I'm the first game, Forbidden West. I did literally everything I could. And I kind of feel like that. If there's a green exclamation point, I can't not do it. I'm sorry. I can't let those poor people down. They're asking me for things.
My Aloy is cold. She's very good. I need your help. No, you don't. The world's ending.
Do you?
Because if I don't do what I'm supposed to do, your cat's going to die anyway. So zip it. Zip it. I'm moving on. I can talk about some of the things that I think are nits for this DLC, and I think also kind of where this franchise is now. One, well, I respect the heck out of it. This is post-game only DLC. Much like the Frozen North. I'm going to keep saying Frozen something until I get what that first game's DLC
was. I feel like it
was
Frozen Wilds. I feel like that was the right one. I'll look it up. Hang on.
Okay, ahead. I'm not going to. I'm just going to keep adding.
Yeah, keep getting it wrong. That's Frozen. What we do here.
that game started you with the very hard, like, Snow Leopard Robo Dino fight, or that expansion. And this one also, it just throws you into it. And as someone who finished Forbidden West, you know, reasonably soon after that game came out and haven't gone back to it since, I kind of did what I wanted to do with that game. Man, I could have used maybe even optional, like we talked about for Firewall Ultra. Like, give me an option for an intro instead of an option for button press reload. Like, go ahead, Ian.
Yeah, I was just going to say, previously on Horizon, it's hard to do the controls.
Yes. Yeah. Less of a plot previously and more of like a, hey, your save is from 10 months ago. Do you want to go to this combat pit and relearn? I'd be like, well, yes, I do.
In the game's defense, it doesn't just shoot you into the Burning Shores. You could just load the game up. You have to go to a place to initiate the DLC content. You could go and refamiliarize yourself with the game.
Yes, but even then, I'm at an in-game save, and that isn't... to me, yes, you can. Yes, the player, you can technically do anything you want in the game, but I would appreciate an option of the game reminding me in a way, and not forcing it, but being like, hey, dude, you sure?
How are your skills, DLC, bro? How are your skills?
This DLC. Also, do you remember your weapon loadout? Do you remember why you had the Tripcaster equipped? Because I don't know if you're going to need it now. I'm like, man, why did I have the Tripcaster?
I have that problem with Breath of the Wild. I've tried to complete that game twice now, and each time I've kind of gone off to do other stuff, come back and gone, what is all this stuff in my...
Yeah.
What are these...
Also my experience anytime loading a new World of Warcraft expansion. It's like, what is this bag full of garbage that I've been carrying around? But the good thing about an expansion like that is you can literally delete everything in your inventory and start with the new expansion.
Yeah, here it's like, why am I so fire arrow heavy? Do I need all that? I don't think I need all. And then I go to respec, and I'm like, oh, all my other weapons stink. Well, fire heavy, you know, and then press forward. So I would love that. And I think the other part of it for me, broadly speaking, again, until we do our spoiler chat, is Horizon, the first game, felt like the best version of the then world of open world games. Like, it learned all of these lessons from all of these open world games that came before it, and I think made the best representation of that style of game. And I think Forbidden West continued that with more engrossing side quests and, you know, some interesting combat mechanics, like breaking off specific chunks of armor became more of a thing, and how you would upgrade and stuff like that. And now coming back to the game and Burning Shores, it still feels like that. And it feels like it's become quickly dated. And I think that open world games, other games have kind of pushed that genre forward. And I think Tears of the Kingdom is going to do that again in a potential large leap. And this is still the, you'll go into a town and it's like, we've joked about press X to mourn. This game, you know, it has a button, press X to greet Karja Warrior. Like, what does that do? Like, what honest to goodness value add? You press X. Hi. Hey, Aloy. Okay. There's no there. I can do it because it makes the world feel more alive, I guess, but it feels at the same time empty. And that's kind of how I feel about this landscape, where I love going back to LA. Don't get me wrong. That's awesome. I love seeing my city in video games. Very cool. But even there, it feels like everywhere I land, I'm landing in a super bloom, you know, like every flower is blooming. Every tree is perfect. The wind is blowing. There's dust, like glint everywhere. The everything is happening at all times. And it's like, so, and this is of just
your
Horizon.
Your argument is too beautiful. The game is too beautiful.
When everything is everything, it becomes nothing. And I think that this game, it highlights it now playing this DLC, that I think the level design, until you're in those maybe bespoke, narrow, funnel, scripted moments, they've justified it by giving you a focus. But without that focus and those prompts, everything feels at some point generic. It feels like, hey, give me beautiful world. There's nothing that compels me to pull me one place or another. Or it's like, oh, well, I can just go explore. But then when I go explore, what do I get? Well, there's a random dino, and I can get that dino for hopefully a good roll of this piece that I need, so that then I can get this piece to upgrade this gear that I need. But I actually don't really need to upgrade that gear, because the game can't require me. It's not requiring me to do that thing. So if I don't get that gear and upgrade that bow, it doesn't prevent me from doing the rest of the game. Like, there's just push-pull that I feel like the game, that open world games have improved upon. And revisiting Horizon a year later reminds me of how dated it now feels by comparison. Man, to me.
I am baffled by this, and I suspect that we will diverge yet again, as we did with Forbidden West, with this DLC, because I suspect that all those things that you are describing as negatives will be positives to me. Like, oh, everything's in full bloom. It's amazing. Oh, I could just go over here and get this dino if I want to. Oh, that's I upgrade my gear if I want to. I don't have to, but I can. I think it, for me, all those feel like positives, or at least they did in the main game. So I suspect we'll differ again.
And I think depending on when we do the spoiler talk, I'll be able to contrast this game to another game.
Okay. All right.
Which I think might help some of these points. And then I think we'll do it in the spoiler talk, but the narrative, there are moments of that left me very flat, which I think is a bummer, because I love Aloy and I love that world. And this provided some interesting choices, I think, is what I'll say.
Just to close the loop on this, it is the Frozen Wilds was the DLC from Zero Dawn. I think there's something telling about when you're unable to remember a thing, you know? Frozen Wilds is just two words stuck together. It doesn't have enough identity, I think, to be memorable. And I think part of the, you know, burning, you know, Forbidden West, Frozen Wilds, Burning Shores, they're all, there's not enough, I don't know. Those, they're not memorable to me. They're hard to remember the specific words because the words feel a little arbitrary.
To that point, and to Burning Shores, I wouldn't consider this a spoiler. I don't think Burning Shores delivers on the promise of its premise, of its landscape.
Nothing's burning. Nothing's a shore.
There's lots of shores. But Frozen Wilds was like, I get it.
It was wild.
I never had the high ground and said, you were the chosen one. You know what I mean? Like, that's all I wanted.
All right.
I can't wait to talk. I've been stepping around the Burning Shores.
Sounds like the thing you really were disappointed with, we can't talk about yet, but we will.
Also, there's some mechanics. There's some stuff, Jeff, and I want to respect
play
your playthrough.
Christian, there's lots of other things. There's things we can't talk about yet that we have that we can't play, that we're playing. It's hard.
I know.
Okay.
I know.
But the things I have been playing and can talk about, I want to talk a little bit about a game called Dredge, which is an indie game. I think we had a guest talk about it last week before, one of the weeks. And I was intrigued by it, so got myself a copy of Dredge on Steam. This is a game. Every descriptor you could give to this game is not something that I would ever think that I would want to play. Fishing game. Don't care. Could not care less about fishing in my life. In the real world, in video games, never ever liked a fishing game in a video game. Fishing mini game, fishing sub, whatever. Never drawn to it. I'm not going to stand on the shore with Link and fish for hours. I'm not going to fish in World of Warcraft. I'm not a fish. I don't care.
But yet you'll go find a random dino?
Yes. Yes, that is very cool.
Dino hunting, very different than hunting for fish. Total different. Total different.
Yes. And if you can't see the difference, I'm shocked. Anyway, this is a game about fishing. You're a fisherman. You fish constantly in this game. So, again, you wouldn't think I would like it. Also, it's kind of this eldritch horror, dark, push-your-luck game. I can like those. I liked Darkest Dungeon, for example, but not usually my jam. So, those two mix of things. You would think Kryptonite for me, but turns out Dredge, quite fun to play. I've been enjoying it. I think our guest, I can't remember which guest it was that brought this game up, but when we were talking about it before, they described it as being very almost meditative and zen-like and sort of an easy game to play. And I found that to be true. I enjoyed the fact that basically, so you're this fisherman that washed up on shore with a broken boat on this island, and they give you a new boat. It's got nothing. It's a junker. And you got to sort of build your boat up so that you can go farther and farther away. And you got to pay off your boat. They gave you a boat, but they need the money back. So you got to fish, sell fish, pay off your boat. And then as you're going, you start to notice some pretty creepy stuff happening in the waters around there. Monsters and darkness. And when you go out, you fish. And then when the sun sets, things get real weird, so you don't want to be out when the sun sets until, you know, you're powerful enough that you can go out when the sun sets. But then, you know, if you turn a light on your boat, you attract real bad stuff. So it's got this really interesting push and pull, push your luck. How far can you go? There's not combat, so you're not going out and attacking the creatures. You're just fishing. And the fishing is, I would describe as pretty uninteresting. As far as there's little fishing mechanic where you have to time your button presses to be inside little green sections. You're rotating around and you push the button at the right moment. If you fail it, unlike literally every fishing mini game I've ever played in any game, if you fail it, you don't lose the fish, you lose time. And so it takes longer to get the fish. And you have this ticking clock of the sun is setting. So you... It's a really interesting, it doesn't feel as punitive, but it also does cost you something because time is your resource as far as I got to get enough fish before the sun sets or things start getting bad.
Right. So is it like a jump? You said it was a horror game. Is it more jump scary or is it more like a tension, a building, rising horror kind of?
Yeah, it's push your luck. It's stuff's out there. It's, oh my gosh, they're going to destroy my boat. The boat is very fragile. You have to pay money to fix things. It's venture out farther, go in, upgrade your boat, get a better rod and reel to get different kinds of fish, get a better engine to go faster, get some upgrades on your boat. You can go farther, venture out farther. Now you can go even farther and get to cooler fish that are worth even more money that help you, you know, buy other things to go farther. And then maybe you'll find a message in a bottle that reveals some piece of interesting information about the world that reveals sort of this underlying horror storyline. But no, definitely no jump scares. It's just that push your luck. How far can you go? How far can you get to the edge before you know your boat just destroyed? But I enjoy it. I think it's a really well-crafted game. I love the art style. It's got this really lovely, almost painterly, like an impressionist painter. Like all the characters are in these big, broad, thick color lines that look like Van Gogh almost. They're a big, you know, impressionist painterly look to it that I find very attractive. And the game is very much not the kind of game I would ever gravitate to, but I found myself spending hours in it. I enjoyed the process of upgrading my boat, and the fishing is sort of mindless. And usually that would be a big knock for me of like, well, there's nothing really to this fishing mechanic. But it was kind of nice to just go out and get some fish. Oh, and when you get you have this hold, the storage area in your boat, and it's made up of a grid of squares. And the fish are in different shapes of grids, so almost like tetraminos. One fish will be, like an L shape. And so you can rotate the fish and you got to fit them in your hold. There's a fun little aspect to that. It's got some clever ideas.
Like the Resident Evil, inventory kind of thing, but with a bit more of a shaped fish.
Right? Yes, exactly. Okay. But made into a little bit more of a game, more of a puzzle of like, how are you going to fit the fish in before you go back to, how can you maximize your space before you have to go back to the shore?
So is the shore burning or not? What's the status of the shore? Burning?
Sure, not burning, but okay. That seems like it's accurate for Horizon as well.
Not burning, just spooky.
Just spooky, yeah. spooky. Anyway, that game is called Dredge, and I think it's a very worthwhile little indie game, and very different, very interesting, cool idea, well executed. All right, so that brings me to the Street Fighter 6 demo. Am I the only one that downloaded this on PlayStation 5?
I downloaded it about an hour before we started recording just to swat up because I saw it in the show notes. So I've played about 20 minutes of it.
Okay. So it's only available on PlayStation as of right now. I guess it comes out next week on Xbox and Steam. So I've only played it on PlayStation. Very, very, very much looking forward to Street Fighter 6. I have been very excited about Street Fighter 6. And so I dove in. Now, there was a big presentation that revealed a lot of what the demo showcases. There's a lot of stuff that you can't do in the demo, as you might expect from a demo. But one of the things it does let you do is try out this new, oh gosh, I don't remember the name of the mode. What is it called?
World Frozen Wilds.
World Tour, maybe? Anyway, yes.
World Tour. World Tour, yes.
Yeah. So this is the, FIFA story mode, NBA 2K, build your character. This is, you will be a Street Fighter, but you make your own avatar. You make your own character. You build it how you want. It has attributes. And then we have role-playing elements and a story that builds you up from nothing into the massive Street Fighter. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, based on this demo, that mode is going to be goofy. Goofy. First of all, you're introduced to it by this, we want strength. You got to, even before that, and Ian, maybe you saw this, there is there is a cutscene that is basically like, We have cars that drive themselves now.
Oh, yes.
We're going to send people to Mars. And yet people still want to fight on the streets. I guess mm-hmm. they do. Street Fighter. It's like, what?
Yeah, it was a very bizarre opener to that.
Then you get into it and you build your character. And, you know, I assume, and I, you know, even the demo shows some of this where you're going to go to a shop and get clothes and, you know, your character is going to get more sophisticated and you're going to have more personalization options. But from the start of building your character, you make really vanilla characters for a mm-hmm. game that is renowned for having these wildly different cast of characters. My dude looks like a boring dude.
Yeah, same here.
Boring. And I get it. You know, you'll acquire stuff, but you know, if you're looking at Dalsim and Chun-Li and Blanka, like, my dude could not be more boring. You remember the very first Street Fighter II cabinet where it's just a guy in a white t-shirt punching? That's my guy. It's just like plain white tee. Anyway. So you build your character, and then it starts, and you go to this gym, and you meet Luke, who's going to be your gym teacher, and everybody's like, we got to find strength. We're doing this for strength. Go get strength. And then a little guy befriends you, and he's like, hey, Luke, if we're going to train together, only one of us can get true strength. How will we remain friends if only one of us will get strength? And I'm like, why is strength a resource that can be used up? Like, what? That makes no sense. Anyway, these are little...
Spoken by the guy on this podcast who clearly didn't get the strength. Go ahead. Ian and I evenly divided the strength. The rule for DLC is only one guest cannot have strength, and that's you, Jeff.
Enjoy
your weakness.
I freely admit that. I am no strength. I didn't have the strength to stomach this. Again, these are nits that I'm picking because it feels really goofy. But then you get into the role-playing section and it is full-on peak role-playing game where you've got your phone and your phone is where you communicate to your trainer and they send you missions through your phone and you have to keep track of contacts. And it's got all this clunky dialogue where that you're forced to scroll through that is... I mean, I know I'm being really negative, but it just felt excruciating to me. Mm. And then you're walking around an open world street, and I understand we're in a game called Street Fighter, but Christian, I don't know if you know this, but this is a game where you can walk up to almost any person on the street and challenge them to a fight.
That's better than greeting them. Game on. That's what I need in Horizon. There is a greet card your warrior. Fight card your warrior.
There is a guy operating a hot dog truck. And you walk up to him, he's like, hey, would you like to buy a hot dog? You're like, no. How about a street fight? And the guy's like, yeah, it's on. And you fight. And it's just a dude in a white apron that sells hot dogs. And you fight him. You can literally walk up to anybody. People are like in the park, or, you know, eating their lunches. People are shopping. You walk up to them. Let's fight. And then they just do it. And no one says boo. No one gets up and watches. It's just have a fight in the street. You are a street fighter.
No one calls the cops. You know, what's going on? These guys are fighting in the street. What's happening?
I feel like they took the title of their series too seriously in this one instance. That's what I'm saying. You understand the game is called Street Fighter.
Hmm. It felt a little bit to me like a Yakuza game, like a Judgment game, you know, where you wander around and occasionally you just fight random people. It was like that, but simplified massively.
Massively. Well, we'll get to the simplifications in a second, but I will say this feels to me like a Monkey Paw situation because for years when I was a kid, when I was enamored with Street Fighter II and its offshoots, I would often say, why doesn't somebody make a game where it's a full-on adventure role-playing game, but all of the combat is a Street Fighter level, Street Fighter fight. Hmm. And they finally did it here. It just feels really weird. I don't know. I'm really worried about this mode. Now, the other thing, talking about simplified, and Ian, I'm curious what your thoughts about this are. There are new control modes. So you can have the classic mode where you got to do a half circle to throw a fireball and your dragon punch is a dragon punch and all the things that anybody who's played Street Fighter for 20 years, 30 years, whatever it's been, knows or is familiar with or understands. But they've also
can pull off flawlessly every time like me. I never miss one of those.
Well, you have achieved strength. or, and what they suggest when you start playing it is they have a new mode. They call it the modern control mode where just push some buttons, man. Just push some buttons. Do you want to do a combo? Hold down R2 and push some buttons and it'll make one for you. Just do it. Just keep pushing buttons. You'll do a combo. Do you want to do, you know, a dragon punch? Push triangle. Just push triangle. Well, what's so hard about that? Just push triangle. It does dragon punch over and over and over. Fine. And I understand the desire to bring these games to a new audience, make them more accessible, make them not so impenetrable and hard. And the classic control mode is still there. Boy, did it feel, it just felt like this game took a massive step back, in my opinion.
You want to reload your own guns, is what I'm hearing.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think so. I think perhaps I do. Ian, you had played 20 minutes of it. What was your first impression?
So I like the fact that in the open world, one of the first things that I saw was an Easter egg to Final Fight. You're in
Mike Hagar.
You're in Metro City, and yeah, Mike Hagar is the mayor. I was like, oh, that's nice. Yeah, the modern control scheme really confused me because I was like, why am I able to spam all these moves really easily? I presume that's just maybe because you can fight everyone. They just want to streamline the fighting. So when you RPG around the world, you can streamline, make fights a little bit easier for yourself.
That's not even the easiest control method. There's another one that's like AI assisted. There's an AI assist control method that's literally like just stand next to someone and the AI will decide what move you should do. It's like
cookie clicker Street Fighter.
Yes.
Like, wow. All right. Well, yeah. I did try out the dual mode. So a player versus AI, and I did that with classic, and that felt you can only play as Luke versus Ryu, and that felt, you know, that felt like normal Street Fighter to me. So
yes, normal Street Fighter is there, so I shouldn't discount that. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I honestly think that, you know, if I'm more of a Mortal Kombat player, to be honest. But if I did pick up Street Fighter 6, I'm not sure how much I'd venture into the world tour. I'd be like calling up my brother to do some like 1v1, you know, fights classic mode rather than the world tour. World tour seems like a nice distraction and a wacky side thing, but maybe not something you'd want to base the entire game around, which almost seems like what they're doing here.
It does seem that way. And it doesn't look good. It does not. It looks really bad, in my opinion.
The fighting against random characters, I don't know about you, but it seemed like the frame rate wasn't as smooth as like normal Street Fighter matches. I don't know. It felt weird and a bit clunky.
Super clunky. And the characters didn't look good. The environments didn't look good. You know, if somebody had just dropped me into that game without telling me what game I was playing, and then they're like, this is actually the newest Street Fighter, I would have been like, what? What?
Capcom?
Yeah. I was very crestfallen by where this is going, and I want to, you know, I want to play Street Fighter with the cool characters, and that's still in the game. And I will say the thing they've done with those splashes of color now, you know, it used to be the inky splashes, and now it's really colorful splashes, like you're playing Splatoon or something. I think that's really cool. I think I love that look. I think that is really eye-catching and different and neat. But man, there's a lot in this game that just feels really poorly thought out. I don't get it. And it's a bummer. That's a bummer. And you have something like, you know, Mortal Kombat that has been just knocking it out of the park the last several iterations with all of the ancillary content and the so much single player stuff to do. And the look of the game is so incredible. And there's so many avenues of exploration in that world. And yet it also still has the core gameplay loop intact. And I feel like this is a really disappointing direction for Street Fighter to take, in my opinion. All right. Let's we have Ian here. We got to do a little VR talk. So let's jump into a little VR. All right, Ian, can you tell us a little bit about your time with Firewall Ultra? I know we talked about that in the first segment of the show, but specifically, like, were you having fun? Did you enjoy it? And then I'd also like, if you don't mind, some PSVR 2 favorites for you. I know that you've been covering PSVR 2 extensively. Yes. I'd love to hear your top hits.
Okay, well, on the subject of Firewall Ultra, I don't know if either of you have played Firewall Zero Hour.
I did on PSVR 1, and I found it to be a pretty frustrating experience, honestly.
Oh, really? I loved it. I was really into the Rainbow Six in VR vibe. I had the AIM controller, so I was like, the AIM controller made movement in Firewall Zero Hour so much easier than using like Move controllers or whatever.
Yeah,
because you have the thumbsticks and stuff on the AIM controller. But so I went into Firewall Ultra very excited to try it out, and I came away a little bit disappointed. It seems like it's going to be a great game, but to me, it felt less of a sequel and more of a 1.5. So we were shown two maps in this demo, and both of the maps were remakes of maps from the original game. I think there's going to be 14 maps in Firewall Ultra, and I think a lot of them are going to be remade, Unreal Engine 5 versions of maps from the first game. So instantly I was like, oh, okay, why aren't you showing me a new map? You know, why are you showing me an old one? This is a preview of a new game, you know. So there was one of the maps was called Social. It's set in a social media office in London, and that has been redone completely. There's new routes. There's a lift been put in so you can go from one floor to the other. And the other map we played was Oil Rig, and that has literally just had a fresh coat of paint. It's exactly the same layout as before. So a little bit disappointed that it wasn't pushing the series and changing up a lot. In terms of the gameplay, it's very, very similar. It's 4v4 squad on squad, diffuser bomb kind of situation. What also worried me during that hands-on, and bear in mind this was early code, was that the guns felt really floaty. It was almost like my arms were moving and my gun was catching up with me. And you can, so during my Eurogamer preview, when I was editing the video coverage for that, I was allowed to film myself playing, but I was only allowed to use 7 seconds bursts of footage for some reason. And there are a couple of clips in there where you can see me and you can see the screen, and you can just about see that as I move my hands, the gun slowly follows. So that made it, and whether this is something that is, you know, needs to be, you know, fixed, a bug fix, or whether it's net code or something, because we were playing against the people in America, it made it a lot harder to aim. It didn't feel as comfortable. Like something like Pavlov, where I'm just going on about Pavlov because I love it, but something like Pavlov, where every movement you make is replicated in the game exactly, was and then you go from that to this, and it felt like I was playing in like jelly. It was really sluggish. So in general, I feel like that game has already been delayed a bit. It was supposed to be a launch title.
Yeah,
I feel like there still needs a bit of work, a bit of polish done to it. If you enjoyed the original, I think you're going to enjoy this one. I went into it expecting more and got the same but shinier.
That's a bit of a bummer. Bit of a bummer.
But in terms of my favorite PlayStation VR 2 games. You could probably guess one of them already. I played a lot.
Right?
Yeah, I played a lot of Kayak.
VR
Mirage. That is really cool. Just visually one of the most impressive games I've seen. And I also really like the Light Brigade. I don't know if you've heard of that one.
I have not tried it yet, but I've heard very good things about it.
Yeah, when it first came out, it was really buggy and the gameplay suffered a lot. But since they've patched it, now it's got that kind of Dark Souls-y in VR vibe. It's more like a roguelite. But it's brutally hard, quite creepy, and that has just got a satisfying gameplay loop to it. So I really like that. And there's another one that I dive into every so often called Runner, which is like it's almost like an Akira motorbike simulator. It's very retro graphics, stylized around 80s, 90s anime. And it's almost like a endless runner, except for you're driving a motorbike and you're also dual wielding pistols and occasionally picking up power-ups. That's a nice little arcadey one to play as well.
Very cool. I'm not aware of this game. It's a
little budget game, but it's wonderful. It's the sort of game that you wouldn't want to spend hours and hours doing, but if you want to dive in, you know, every so often and feel like you're a character in an anime, it's quite good. It has a great vibe to it.
Awesome.
And I think they just are going to or recently patched in the co-op mode also, because I think Runner was it out on Quest or maybe PSVR 1, but it is an update for PSVR 2.
Yeah.
And I do think they brought in a co-op mode so you can have your partner doing the driving or you do the shooting.
Fun.
It's coming. If that's out or
not, try the co-op. Yeah.
Coming soon for PC VR as well, looks like.
Oh, nice. On the flip side of the coin, though, I did recently, one of the other VR games that I've played recently is a horror game called Afterlife VR, which came out this week. And it's probably the worst PlayStation VR 2 game I've played so far. It is ugly. It doesn't control very well. The horror is so badly implemented. The puzzle mechanics are just nonsensical, and I streamed the first 2 hours of it on my personal YouTube channel. Well, I say I streamed the first 2 hours of it on my personal YouTube channel. I gave up after about an hour and 50 because I was like, do you know what? I can't play this anymore. It's terrible. All the monsters look like they're lifted from an asset store, and the voiceovers are terrible. The intro is completely ripped off from Outlast. Like you're in a car driving towards the old tropey mental asylum, you know, or where can I set a horror movie? Oh, mental asylum. Yeah. There are other places that could be spooky, but you know, it was bereft of ideas and fun. And if you are looking for a VR horror game, Resident Evil, don't do Afterlife.
Yeah.
You'll waste your, I think it's budget, but still there's better things out there to spend your money on.
Well, there you go. Snapshot of PlayStation 2 VR games, good and bad, ladies and gentlemen. But I love your passion for it. I'm a fan of watching your content, the reviews that you make about PSVR 2 and, I'm a huge fan of VR as a medium as well. So
I'm a massive fan of VR. I do understand why it struggles, but there is some magic in there that I haven't felt in gaming for a long time. Having played games since the 80s, there's something about VR that just elevates games. You know, I play a lot of flat screen to VR mods. There's a brilliant community, flat screen to VR modding community. And the way they take these flat games I love and bring them into VR, and then it feels like you're visiting a place you've seen in photos and actually going there. It's like looking at a holiday brochure and then actually going on holiday there. And another, it's just breathing new life into your favorite games. And even though I know that VR is going to struggle to be mainstream, there's so much to enjoy there that I just wish more people would give it a go.
Couldn't agree more. Well said, eloquently said. I totally agree. And evidently there is this very soon, there is going to be this universal Unreal Engine to VR mod. This guy's been working on.
Praydog, yes.
Yes, yeah, Praydog, exactly. And I am so excited about that. There's been lots of teases about all sorts of games that already just work immediately because they're Unreal Engine games, which I think is incredibly exciting.
Yeah, so, I can't wait for that to come out soon, hopefully.
Yeah. I was just talking last week about the Half-Life Episodes 1 and 2 mods.
Oh, yes, I played those ones.
So good, so good. And it really is an exciting notion that if a game comes out on Unreal, it will be trivial to get it to work in VR. And I think that's going to open up a whole range of experiences.
Honestly, a universal plug-and-play VR mod for all 90% of Unreal Engine 4 games is going to be a game changer for VR on PC.
All right. Well, that does it for this episode of DLC. We do have parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those. But Ian Higdon, thank you so much for being here. It's been so much fun chatting with you.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a great time. Great fun.
Absolutely. Tell folks where they can keep up with you and all the cool stuff you do online.
Well, you can check me out almost daily over on youtube.com/Eurogamer. I'm there with my fellow video producers, Zoe and Aoife. We cover a wide variety of games, whether it be in previews or live streams. I'm also available most evenings in streams on my personal YouTube channel, youtube.com/platform32. I do a lot of community stuff there, play PUBG and Fall Guys and stuff with my viewers. And I also host a podcast called Virtual Criminality. That's on hiatus at the moment because it takes a long time to do the episodes. But that's what I do with that is I tell the story of video game villains in the style of a true crime podcast plus true crime video documentary, because I do a podcast version and a YouTube version as well. So the YouTube version, I will create a documentary that looks like a true crime documentary, but using video game footage. So the last episode I did was, it was called The Unsolved Goose Crimes. So it was based on Untitled Goose Game. And it was all about how a duck runs rampant around a village, terrorizing the locals. And then I used the gameplay for that. I took police helicopter camera overlays and made it night vision and turned that into kind of like a, you know, police camera footage from a helicopter following a goose on its trail of destruction. So I've done a variety of episodes of that.
Such a brilliant idea. I love it. It's such a clever idea.
But that, search Virtual Criminality on podcast apps, or you can find the documentary video versions on Platform 32 as well.
Very cool. Christian Spicer, what about you? What do you got going on this week?
My website's probably the best place, which is just christianspicer.com. I have a blog there, which occasionally I will blog to. I use it mostly when embargoes happen.
You may want to tune in on Wednesday this week, right, Christian?
No, I don't know what you're talking about. Sometimes embargoes happen almost exactly between when we record shows. Yeah,
very, very frustrating when that happens, by the way.
And so sometimes I will blog those on my website, which is christianspicer.com. You can also buy copies, physical copies of, I always say this and I look that like I prepared and put one close that I can hold on. I never do. Every week I'm like, nope, I didn't. They're still too far away. But of my graphic novel, Consequences, I have a few physical copies left. I'm sending those out to folks. You can find that there on my website as well. And then I write long form about games at tinyletter.com/Christian Spicer about once a month. It's been a little less than that recently because of all of the games. It's like, it's frustrating when don't get me wrong, first world problem, but it's like, I'm spending too much time playing games that I'm not able to do the other thing that I love to do about games, which is write about them in long form. But it's like, I don't have time to write about it because I'm still playing and I got to move to the next one. But I do love that newsletter, and I know what the next one will be, and it is inspired by something I mentioned a little bit on this week's episode of all the press conferences, but it's a broader view of too much of a good thing. And the thesis is, are we living in an age now past the golden age of streaming or TV or video games? And now are we in the gluttony And is that actually bad? Is it bad that we can't have a monoculture in the way we used to be forced to have? Because we all watched G.I. Joe. Did some people love it? Sure. Did everyone watch it because you had to? Yeah. So that's the thesis of the next one. It'll be at tinyletter.com/Christian Spicer if you want to subscribe to that.
You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. I have other shows. I have a movie and TV review podcast. It's called The Film Cast. You can find it wherever you get podcasts. I do a comedy science show where you can learn something and laugh along the way. It's called We Have Concerns. And I do a sports show called The Fan Controlled Show, The Fan Controlled Sports and Entertainment. All of those available wherever you get your fine podcasts, or also video versions, you know, on places where you get video things. Find it. You can do it. I know you can. All right. That's going to bring us to our parting gifts.
Hey, give us a suggestion.
Ian, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
I have started listening to a new band called St. Agnes. They are I think the genre is screamo. I'm not 100% sure of that, but there is a fight in Dead Island 2 that is you're introduced to a new zombie type that screams really loud, and then this song from St. Agnes comes on called And They All Fall Down, and the zombie smashing action and this like screaming and this screamo music as well, it all goes together really well. And I was like, I'm gonna Shazam that song or whatever that app was. And I found it, and I found the band, and now they're my workout playlist for the week. So St. Agnes is a good band to search for.
St. Agnes, love it. Very fun. Christian Spicer, what about you? Parting gift.
One, also music. Ian Dior released a new album, Leave Me Where You Found Me. I'm a big fan of Ian's work, and it kind of straddles this rap/pop punk. You know, he's worked with Machine Gun Kelly and Black Bear and folks like that. And this new album, I think, has some incredible tracks on it. As an album, it feels a little disjointed. His last album, I would just play, and it felt like the songs would lead into each other and hit in that way. And this album doesn't quite flow like that, in my opinion. But Liar is an incredible track. 10 by 3 is an incredible track. And this album is a little more rap focused, a little moving away from a little bit of the pop punk stuff type stuff. And I like seeing Ian do that. It's super fun. And then the other one that I keep failing to mention, so I'm going to do two now. I've kind of fallen back into physical media for magazines. I subscribe to Edge, and I got my first copy recently because it comes from across the pond and it takes a while to get here. Road and Track, a couple of others, and I love it. I know we talked about Kindles before and this, that, and the other, but I think there is something great about holding a magazine and also my mental ability to focus on physical media. And I think the Kindle solves that problem for me as well. But there'll be times where I'm reading an article I like, you know, on my computer, on my phone, and I'm like, oh God, how long is this? Because I know that I'm going to move to something else at some point, right? Like something else on my phone is going to take my attention. I'll open up a new web browser. I won't go back to it. And with a physical, tangible thing, I can be like, oh, put it down and then come back to it. And I find that I'm reading things that I would otherwise skip online, which might sound weird, but I like I'm reading through this Road and Track, and there's like a whole celebration of 24 Hours of Le Mans as we're getting back into that. And when I see those online, oftentimes I'd be like, I don't care about the 1972 Le Mans race, but then I have it in the magazine and it's one of 20 articles. It's like, well, I'm going to read this, and it's this fascinating thing. And so I think there's something precious about being served things that aren't tailor suited for things you quote unquote like, and expanding your reading appetite for different stories. And the same is true in Edge. I was reading about the cover is everything. It was fascinating stories about that. But then there's also, you know, long form, incredible articles about games I otherwise would be like, that doesn't feel in my wheelhouse. But the way they're written and presented and having it in my hand allows me to read them, and I really enjoy them. So I think if you have lapsed on physical media, you know, find one that you think you might like and give it a subscribe. Shockingly cheap.
Magazines. That's cool.
So that's my second one. Yeah.
Very cool. I'm going to recommend a movie that I had a chance to see this last week. It's the new Guy Ritchie movie. It's called The Covenant. Very much not a what you would think of as a Guy Ritchie movie. If you're thinking of, you know, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels or that kind of very stylized genre movie, this isn't it. This is Jake Gyllenhaal as a soldier in, I think, around 2002 in the Middle East. And I don't want to spoil anything. I think that I've been told the trailer really does spoil most of this movie, and that's a shame because I didn't know anything about it going in, and I was completely transported. It is quite a journey. It is quite a tale. It almost feels like three movies in one. And I was really impressed with it. I had a really, really great time. I was completely drawn in, didn't know what to expect at all, and it takes you for a ride. So if you are interested at all in, you know, for me, you know, that time period, a military, it really doesn't particularly interest me. But this movie has something I think to really bring to the table that is unique and interesting, and I would highly recommend. Don't know anything about it going in because it takes you for a journey. It's called The Covenant. It's in movie theaters now. We also got a listener suggested parting gift. This was sent to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. It comes from Ryan. Ryan says, after listening to you recount your experiences on the paid DLC bonus show about your eye health checkups, which I did this last week, I wanted to reach out and encourage all listeners to get their eyes checked on a regular basis. For a large part of my life, I've been seeing an optometrist yearly since I was a child. In 2008, 2009, they identified a small hole in my retina. I had no real symptoms to know an issue was there. I saw a specialist to have it fixed, and it's been in good shape ever since. For my part, seeing the optometrist is an uncomfortable experience, but I much prefer that over having my teeth cleaned at the dentist. There are bright lights and some pressures on the eye, but for me, those parts only last a few minutes. When I had my retina repaired, I remember there being more procedures, but still better than the dentist. A visit in Ontario, Canada is usually between $150 and $200 for a checkup, and it's well worth it, in my opinion. Often corporate health plans or insurance will reimburse part of that cost. Have your eyes checked regularly so we can keep enjoying our vision along with our favorite hobby of video games. Thanks, Ryan. Great reminder. I can certainly attest to that as a poster child of catastrophic eye surgery, which I wouldn't recommend on my worst enemy. So yes, definitely get your eyes checked on a regular basis. You know, I consider myself still relatively young, and I had something happen in my eyes that shouldn't have happened for another 20 or 30 years for me. So, you know, you never know what can happen to you. And it's mildly uncomfortable, but well worth it. Thank you, Ryan, for sending that in. And if you'd like to have your parting gift on our show, we'd love to hear it. Send it to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. All right. That's it for this episode. Thanks again to Ian Higdon and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those fun bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. You can get swag for the show, like what I'm wearing right now, t-shirts, at dlcswag.com. Jesse J. Anderson put that site together for us, and we appreciate it. We also need to thank our patrons, without whom the show wouldn't exist. So thank you, patrons, for supporting us. Our top tier patrons, the Hype Train patrons, get their names read out at the end of every episode, which I'm going to do right now.
Hello. I want to tell you about some of the folks that have made this show possible. Folks like Tyler, Buckwild Brode, Dwayne T. Robinson, Rob Wonder Rob Dominguez, Stephen T. Seifert, Kevin Ede, Brian Jordan, Hyperboy66, Scott Lambert, David F., Sho Ryuken, comedian Aaron Trahan, John Sisko, Curtis from Louisville, Relentless Rex, Michael S., Andy Joyce, Matt Valdez, Kyle Starr, Anthony Goulas, Dan Flanagan, Riley Knox, Rob Rickman, Sasan Adam Denby, Hank Patton, Victor Valenzuela, Scooby Diesel, Cheesy Bob, Jonathan Talbert, Chris Zacharias, Matt Bradley, Jeff Luxack, Will with one L Harris, Mitchell Ness, Jonathan Putney, Mark Gowland, Jimmy Radcliffe, Malcolm King, Dan Palmino, Scott Hughes, Ben, Kevin Brazel, Stu Goss, Nate, Jenny, Zachary White, Jonathan, Spice Man Forever Schlepfer, Yick, Albert of the Stuff and Junk Show podcast, Soren Silk, Travis, Mike Lombardo, The Spice Man Silencer, Michael Buck, Jackson, Michael Stadler, Nick Strauss-Klein, Peter Olberg, Josh Peek, Jad, Christian Bravery, Taylor Wiggert, Octavian Ratzio, and of course, Jason Novak. Those are just some of the people that make this here podcast possible. And you could be one of them too. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/DLCpod.
All right. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.